Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, my very special guest is Dr. Brian Hare, a scientist and the New York Times bestselling author of The Genius of Dogs. He received his PhD from Harvard University and is now a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. Brian founded the Hominoid Psychology Research Group while at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and subsequently founded the Duke Canine Cognition Center. His publications on dog cognition are amongst the most heavily cited papers on dog behavior and intelligence. In this interview, Brian talks about his new book, Survival of the Friendliest, which masterfully applies research on the psychology of dogs, chimps, and bonobos to our understanding of human benevolence and cruelty. He explains why identifying with a group can result in hostility to others, and why species that find a way to cooperate tend to dominate. He also offers innovative solutions for reducing divisiveness and increasing cooperative behavior in our contemporary society. Just before we get into this week's interview, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions twice a week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from aluminium foil to athlete's foot. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and you can sign up there. Again, that's nbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's interview with Brian Hare. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's a delight to be with you. It's so exciting to be able to talk to you about all this stuff.
Well, I certainly share your excitement. I've very much been enjoying your books of late. I think I found you through your, was it your first book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think?
Yes. I wrote it with Vanessa Woods, my wife, and that was my first book, but not her first book.
Okay. Yes, I very much enjoyed that book, and especially the word dognition. We were thinking, I work with a neurologist, and we were thinking we might start an elite dognition training program. I thought that'd be excellent.
That can work.
Everyone cares about cognition, right?
They do. Even your dog.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was absolutely fantastic. And then more recently, I've been reading your new book, Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity, which is also fantastic. I'm very much looking forward to the Audible version of that book. I'm a listener of book more than I am a reader on Kindle. And so far, I've only read the Kindle version. I think it's really important to say that I don't want anyone to think that they've read the book just because they've listened to this interview. You're going to have to go get it. And we're just going to scratch the surface here today. But maybe we could start at the beginning. I'll ask you this question. Tell us about what you learned about shared intentionality from your dog, Oreo.
Well, really what happened was I learned more about science than I did about dogs from my childhood dog, because I, like every dog lover, played fetch with my dog, and he would lose stuff and I would try to help him find it by gesturing and pointing in the direction that his ball had gone and he didn't know where it was. I didn't think that was remarkable at all. I was just a little kid with my dog playing fetch. And, you know, if I pointed, he would go orbit in that direction. I'd seen it 1,000 times. And so it was when I got to college and I was working with Mike Tomasello, fantastic developmental psychologist and evolutionary psychologist. And he said to me, as we were talking about work that I was helping him with chimpanzees, that understanding gestures where someone communicates where something is or orienting your attention in the direction that you want them to attend and pay attention to, so you can do something together or think about something together, that that's really special to humans. And that didn't really strike me, but he said, and it's unique that only humans do this.
Right.
And then I was like, I think my dog does that. I just kind of blurted it. I just kind of blurted it out. I was just like, yeah. I was only 19. I didn't know not to say that stuff. And so,
right.
So I was like, I think my dog does that. And so that's how it all started. His response was classic, though. We're big buddies. And his response was, yeah, everybody thinks their dog does calculus. And he said, look, dogs are the textbook example. And he literally pulled an old textbook out. He said, look, right here, it says when you point for a dog, it looks at your finger. And it doesn't use the gesture. And I'm like, he didn't have a dog. He hadn't had a dog since he was a kid. So I said, nah, I don't think that's not the way it goes.
So explain the experiment, the classic experiment.
Well, I have to always say that, you know, not all science is rocket science, because I'm up talking with people using fMRI and doing polygenetic scores using all sorts of fancy technology. And what we did to figure this out is we hid food under one of two cups. And then I just pointed to where the food was. And the question was 50-50 chance. If you can use my gesture, you're going to be above 50%. If you can't, you're not going to know where it is, especially if you can't use your nose to find it, which we were able to show. If I didn't use my gesture, Oreo was just guessing and at 50-50. But if I gestured, it was very easy for him to find it 100% of the time. So your original question was, what did I learn about shared intentionality from my dog? And it was more that I was taught by my dog that they cooperate and communicate with us in a really rich and interesting way. And I didn't know that that was interesting until I got to college. And then the truth is that we discovered something that dog owners have known forever. It's just that I think what dog owners didn't understand. And then what we were able to do is show how that ability compares to other species. And I don't think dog owners would have known how important that is for human development.
Right. I have to say, I do admire the beauty of your experiments. Like, if simplicity is beautiful, then surely your experiments are beautiful. Like, doesn't, you know, when you read some of these studies, you know, these genome-wide association studies, and there's 100+ authors on the thing, you're like, how the hell can I even begin to understand? How the hell can any one person begin to understand what just happened here? Whereas you can read about your experiments and you can try them in the kitchen at home. It was the first thing I did when I started reading The Genius of Dogs.
Yep. I get it.
It's so beautiful.
It's fun because I have a lot of students, right? And they want to work with us. And they're, oh, I don't know. I was like, I was 19 and I went to my parents' garage and my first paper was on my two pet dogs. So, you know, if you want, you can contribute. There's a way. And that was sort of what inspired, and I know you know about Dognition, and that sort of inspired our citizen science approach.
Yeah.
Too,
so tell us about, that's a good time for you to tell us about this. So you now have an online program where anybody can sign up for and test their own dog, right?
Yeah, you can play. So 20 years on, we've learned a lot. And now our approaches are getting more complicated. And we're getting more to be like the polygenic folks using fancy statistical models that I don't understand either all the time. But the cool thing is that we have, you know, established a lot of nice paradigms that you, or games you can play with your dog at home and learn about what kind of different cognitive abilities that it's using to solve, you know, everyday problems. I think the fun thing is that a lot of people, when you talk to people who love dogs, I find them to really bifurcate into two groups. There's a group of people who say, I knew that because my dog is so smart. And then there's another group of people who say, oh my gosh, that's great about other dogs, but my dog is so not smart. And they may say it that in other ways. And so when you poke a little bit at that, which given what I do, you end up doing that, you can't help it because I interact with a lot of these people and I'm a psychologist. So you poke a little bit and it ends up that the median and modal response are kind of the same. People always say, the people especially who say their dog is really smart, you say, well, why do you think your dog's so smart? They always say the same story. Oh, my dog can open a door. And I was like, wow, that's what's impressive to you? I mean, they are so much more impressive on so many different things. And the people who say they're not smart, they always say things like, oh, my dog always barks, or I can't stop the bad behavior that I find obnoxious.
Right.
And so I think in Dognition, the gift of Dognition is you can compare your dog's psychology, cognition to other dogs.
Right.
Because if you're saying, oh, something is so smart or so not smart, well, compare to what? And I think the compare to what is other dogs. And so that's what Dognition lets you do. You play the same games that then we help you virtually compare your dog to all the other dogs, and you get to see how your dog compares. So it's a lot of fun. Thousands of people have done it. And the beauty is it's a citizen science project. We've been able to collect all that data and use it. We've published 5 papers this year, I'm really proud to say, and made a lot of really cool discoveries that we couldn't have because we have the biggest data sets on any animal cognition experiment that I know of.
Another tremendous variation in the results. I tried it with my dogs and one of them got it right away, just like in your, like with Oreo, I think. Probably not quite as good as him because I've never seen a dog with multiple tennis balls in its mouth before. But yeah, Kipper got it straight away. But Tiger, it's just like, I couldn't even train him to do it, you know, like he was really terrible. And it's kind of interesting to compare the two dogs because one is much more like a feral dog, like Australian cattle dogs are basically dingoes, which is a feral dog. And Tiger is the more feral of the two, you know, super high adrenaline with cocked ears and a tail that goes up very easily and hackles that go up very easily. And I couldn't even train him to do it. But do you find that there's tremendous variability in the results?
Yes. And I think the first thing that is a surprise to people is we have not seen in our cognitive measures, and I'm very careful to say cognitive measures because temperamental measurements of emotional reactivity and emotional responses, that's a different ballgame. But in cognitive measures, things like understanding human communication or responding to eye contact or making inference, remembering things, those kinds of measures really see breed or the breed of a dog explaining much variability. There's, first of all, tremendous individual variability, but it does not map onto breed. It tends to be that within a breed, there's tremendous individual variability. So you don't see the prediction that you would make if breed is really important to cognition, which would be that you'd see more variability between than within breeds. And that's not what we see. Breed communicates very little about cognition.
Interesting.
Other than what your dog looks like. So that's a big surprise for most dog lovers because, and it actually is important in thinking about the book because it raises this concept that we don't spend too much time talking about the book, but I do think it's important for the conversation about how we view each other, how we view other humans, is this concept of essentialism. I think part of the reason, and we have some data that's unpublished, part of the reason that people have such a strong feeling that breed communicates everything about their dog behavior, the dog cognition, how smart they are, and everything that we attribute so much to breed is because we have essentialist notions that breed actually communicates some immutable, heritable property that makes a different breed what it is.
And sometimes it does, right? Like honest signaling is a thing, right? The cockerels... what do you call that red thing on the top of the cockerel's head? Like that's honest signaling, right? It does mean something, but you don't know everything about the bird just from that.
Yes. And so in the case of temperament, for instance, there are breeds that are more, that tend to be more reactive than others. There tend to be breeds, for instance, a border collie does the eye stalk where it'll freeze and stalk. So no Labrador retriever is going to do an eye stalk. So I'm not trying to say that there are not breed differences. But what happens is because there are some breed differences, then we think everything is a breed difference. We attribute everything to breed.
Right.
And so the people put so much weight on breed. And the reason I say all this is because I, you know, as somebody who studies dog psychology, I run the Duke Canine Cognition Center. The Duke Puppy Kindergarten is part of that. So we're raising young dogs. And so I got a lot of questions about how do I pick a dog? What breed is the right breed? Blah, blah, blah. And so I know that there are these really strong beliefs about the essence of dogs being communicated by their breed. And it ends up that it doesn't really seem to be the case on most measures that would be relevant to people's happiness and their relationship with their dog. So I think you can overdo breed. The other thing that's really interesting, and we talk about this in the last chapter of the book, is, and again, it seems like it would have nothing to do with humans, but we talk about the origin of breeds. And another thing that I didn't appreciate, because the discovery is only 10 years old, but when comparisons of different genomes, dog genomes have been done, we now know that all the modern dog breeds are, and I shouldn't say modern dog breeds, I should say European dog breeds, are 150 to 200 years old. So the dog breeds that we're most familiar with, that most frequent American homes and, you know, dog parks, whatever, those dog breeds are 150 to 200 years old. But we also know that dogs evolved 25 to 40,000 years ago. So from 25,000 years ago until 200 years ago, the thing that we think of as being dog didn't even exist.
Right.
And so then the question of, well, where did all these breeds come from? What's their origin? Well, you have to just step back and think for 2 seconds. Well, what was going on 200 years ago? Well, that's the height of the Victorian era,
right,
where hierarchy And being able to demonstrate your status in society was quite important in Europe. And so what we think and what we have some interesting evidence to suggest is that breed and our focus on breed is really about us. It's really about what we want to communicate about ourselves by what dog we are interacting with and have as part of our family. And of course, the origin of breeding was that individuals got status by showing that they had a superior, pure line of dog that was in some ways better to inferior, non-pure dogs. This is, you know, at the start of eugenics, and just as evolutionary thinking is reaching to the into the popular mind. So that's where our breeds come from. And so
it's terrifying.
So dog breeds actually are a window into our minds more than they are into the dog's minds.
Right. And talk about chimpanzees, how are they different in terms of their shared intentionality?
So the finding that is remarkable is I've done a lot of work trying to understand what chimpanzees understand about us and bonobos as well, our two close relatives, bonobos and chimpanzees. It's like having two first cousins, one's a girl, one's a boy, but they're equally closely related, even though they're different from each other. So I've spent a lot of time studying each individual species and comparing them to humans and then comparing them to each other as well, trying to understand sort of what might have changed since our lineage split from theirs, and also how they might have changed from each other since their lineage is split as well. So the question about how do you characterize what might have changed in bonobos and chimpanzees, or sorry, what might have changed in our lineage since our lineage split from bonobos and chimpanzees? It seems that the same skill of cooperatively communicating, gesturing to others that's central to human development, that may be something that really is derived. And I say derived, meaning that it's changed since our lineage split. But that's different than unique, because it ends up that dogs, as any dog owner knows, is really good at following our gestures. So that's the big finding, is that as brilliant as bonobos and chimpanzees are, and they can run circles around dogs on most measures of solving novel problems or thinking about what others are thinking. But there's one place where chimpanzees and bonobos really, really struggle, and that's this ability to use gestural communications in a flexible way, like a 9-month-old child does right as it's beginning to participate in culture and learn language. And it ends up that dogs have unbelievable, uncanny ability to do the same thing that is so critical for children, but we see that bonobos and chimpanzees aren't so skillful with.
What did you learn about bonobos? I understand that you spent some time in the Congo, a lot of time in the Congo studying bonobos. What did you learn about them? How are they different from chimpanzees?
So bonobos and chimpanzees are this fascinating case where they are not that different from each other genetically. The analogous comparison would be wolves and dogs, actually. So they're extraordinarily closely related to one another. And in most measures, they're very similar. They eat much of the same stuff. They are about the same size. Their morphological characteristics are very similar to one another. We could go on and on about how similar they are. But in that sea of similarity, there are some really amazing differences. And most of them have to do with their social life, but some of them have to do with their morphology. And I think if I was to summarize quickly the difference between bonobos and chimpanzees, the bonobo looks like the dog of the great ape family in their behavior and their morphology. So if a chimpanzee is like a wolf, a bonobo is like a dog. It ends up that bonobos have a bunch of behaviors that make them extremely friendly relative to chimpanzees. And morphologically, they have some changes that make them very dog-like. Males have much smaller crania. They have smaller canine teeth. They have some less pigment on their lips, on their tails. They don't have tails, but they have little tail tufts. And they have a lot of behavior that's more juvenilized. So they're more playful. They're more sexual into adulthood. They're more tolerant into adulthood. They're better at sharing food into adulthood. And so chimpanzees and bonobos really are quite remarkable because they show that you can have a massive change in friendliness without much genetic change, and that it can have remarkable impact. I think if I was going to summarize the most surprising finding, And the most surprising thing, everyone usually focuses on bonobo sexuality, that bonobos have this sociosexual behavior where they're trisexual. They'll have sexual behavior with anyone, any partner, any age. It doesn't really matter. I think that's actually not the most interesting thing about them at all.
I'm really disappointed. That was the whole purpose of this interview. So you could tell us about bonobo frottage. Can you tell us about bonobo frottage?
There's a lot of bonobo frottage going on. Whether it's penis fencing or GG rubbing, which is females rubbing clitorises together vigorously. And as best we can tell, they have orgasm. And so, yes, we can talk more about that. And it is fascinating and it is relevant to their friendliness. But the thing that is most remarkable about bonobos, and I think how remarkable their sex is, should tell you, boy, what I'm about to say must be super remarkable if it's more amazing than that. And it is. And it is that there's no such thing as bonobocide. So homicide, chimpanzee side, these are things that are quite normal. Chimpanzees and humans murder at similar rates if you're considering humans who live as hunter-gatherers. So Richard Wrangham and Mike Wilson have done some analysis to suggest that that's the case. No bonobo has ever been observed to kill another bonobo. So there's no infanticide. There's no intergroup between two groups of bonobos where a group of bonobos attacks and tries to kill another member of another bonobo group. Male bonobos don't coerce females into having sex. They don't beat or brutalize their mothers. All those antisocial, not very nice behaviors I just described that are absent in bonobos, they're all prevalent and central to chimpanzee sociality. And so you have these two species. One is a total xenophobe. Chimpanzees are terrified of strangers. They're aggressive towards strangers. And then you have bonobos that are almost genetically identical that are xenophilic. And what we found, and back to your original question, which was what's the most surprising thing or what did you discover yourself about bonobos? And what our team found was that it's not just that bonobos are indifferent to strangers. They actually prefer and are attracted and are willing to pay a cost, a personal cost, to interact with a stranger that they won't pay to interact with a groupmate. So they really are xenophilic. They're attracted and prefer to be with strangers, whereas chimpanzees are absolutely xenophobic and terrified of strangers.
Why might that be? What's in it for the bonobo to be xenophilic?
Well, I think it goes back to the thesis of the book. And the thesis of the book is that friendliness pays huge dividends if you can get the cost-benefit ratio right. And often in nature, the cost-benefit gets set so that friendliness pays massive dividends. I think what is often not understood is that aggression is really costly. Being the alpha chimpanzee or the alpha baboon is extraordinarily costly on the individual that is trying to maintain power and monopolize access to matings or food. Usually, alpha tenures are short. And they usually end
stressful.
And they don't usually end well for the individual. So it's a very short-term strategy. Friendliness, if you can pull it off, pays massive dividends. And it really just depends on getting the cost-benefit ratio. And just to make the point, I would suggest that most of the biggest changes in life, and I mean life, occur when there's an increase in friendliness or cooperation. Often the cooperation relies on a new form of friendliness. So flowering plants, for instance, and fruiting plants, they're some of the newest types of plants. They dominate the landscape now because they made a bargain and they cooperate with animals to spread and pollinate. And so that's a great example. Another would be eusocial insects, you know, ants that are eusocial, termites that are eusocial. Increase in friendliness. One of the things we discovered at writing the book is it ends up that termites are closely related to cockroaches. And cockroaches are terribly asocial and aggressive with one another as adults. But when they're young, they're incredibly social and they're very termite-like. And so it ends up that termites evolved by basically maintaining the juvenile or infant-like friendliness throughout their lives.
Neoptonism.
So we can walk through tons of species. Dogs are another great example where friendliness pays huge dividends. Sadly, wolves, I don't think, if you're in California, I think they're extirpated from California.
Yeah, for sure.
And so there are literally millions of dogs in California and there are zero wolves. So that's a great example where dogs evolved through increased friendliness towards humans and building this relationship they have with us. And it paid off big. There's now hundreds of millions of dogs everywhere across the world. And there's a few hundred thousand wolves, sadly. So, you know, the morning the dog woke up and said, the population of wolf woke up and said, hey, you know what? Let's go forage on human garbage versus go hunt. I mean, that was a massive evolutionary moment where friendliness paid off big. So for bonobos, it ends up that the most successful male bonobo is far more successful reproductively than the most successful alpha male chimpanzee that's ever been documented.
Wow.
So friendliness pays big in reproductive success when you can get the cost benefit correctly. I don't think that's what you were asking me though, when you said, well, how do bonobos, because I told you, oh, bonobos don't murder. They don't have infanticide. They don't have intergroup aggression. And then you said, why would they be attracted to strangers? Why would they be friendly to strangers? So I think the answer to that is that if you can extend your social network, it has huge benefits. If you can have more potential friends and allies, and I think this is what happened in the case of bonobos, if the cost drops to nothing or is right, very low. So in the case of chimpanzees, you meet a stranger, someone you're not familiar with, that you didn't grow up with, you've never seen before, you have a fearful reaction because the potential cost of that interaction is that you get significantly wounded. You may even lose your life if there's more of them than there are of you. And now we go to bonobo land, which is apparently on this side of my office, and and you see a stranger, and there is no cost to that interaction. You will not be injured physically. You will not be killed. So there's really only upside. The only potential cost is disease transmission. So because there's no cost, immediate cost of aggression, then okay, let's go make a new friend. And so they're actually attracted, and it helps them expand their network and create allies and friends. So I think that's what happened, is that the cost of having new social relationships drop below a threshold, and then it allows for friendliness to take over.
Well, the reason I think the bonobo sex is interesting, and maybe you disagree with me, is that most of it is non-reproductive. And tomorrow I'm interviewing Sue Carter. She's the preeminent researcher on oxytocin.
That's right.
So if nothing raises oxytocin like orgasm, is that non-reproductive sex for building social networks and alliances, particularly between the females?
I like that idea, and I think Sue will like that idea. We don't have a data set yet to demonstrate that okay, in terms of mechanistically. There is data from zoos in Europe. Martin Serbeck, I think, and Gottfried Hohmann have a data set that suggests that this is something that that team has been working on for decades, trying to understand the sociosexual behavior in the context of wild bonobos. There are many hypotheses about why they have the sexual behavior they have, and they've worked just tirelessly to try to test between them. And they do have some data now that suggests that sexual behavior of females does help with their alliance formation. And my own personal observation, having spent a lot of time with bonobos and having many bonobo friends, because they're wonderful beings, they really are. It is funny because the personality of different species, if you hang out with a lot of species, each individual has a personality, but the species has a personality too. And the way I always characterize it is, you know, you hang out with chimpanzees, you want to be a chimpanzee. They are so cool. They're just like the badasses of the primate world.
Right. So strong.
Jumping through trees, grabbing monkeys and eating them, and, you know, big displays. And oh, man, it's like the kid.
Usain Bolt was only half as fast as an average chimpanzee, right? Like, you think he's fast, but no, not compared to a chimpanzee.
Yeah. So, you know, in high school, that was the kid you'd wanted to be. And for me, bonobos are different in that they are the kid in high school that you would want to be friends with and you'd want to be with. You know, they're fun. They're silly. I cannot tell you times I've seen bonobos behaving and looking at it and be like, I don't understand how you evolved. Like, how are you here? You are so fun and goofy. You know, you just want to be with them. I mean, they're just hams. And it's like, you need to take life seriously, guys. Aren't you supposed to be wild or whatever? And so they're really a lot of fun. So on the sexual behavior, the Sue Carter interview, I think she'll like your hypothesis that maybe oxytocin is being revved up while females are rubbing clitorises and they scream, and, you know, it seems like they're having a positive emotion, and it's hard not to say that it's orgasm, although how in the world would we measure that in a non-invasive way? You can't interview them really, but they seem...
You put them in an fMRI, right?
I guess, yeah. I don't know how you'd sign them up for that. You have to hold really still. So I don't know if those two things are compatible. So here's a surprising find. I actually argue with Richard Wrangham in this new book that bonobos are self-domesticated, that there's been selection for friendliness. It's analogous to what we see in dogs, in that there's been a change in emotional reactivity and that has allowed them to be more tolerant. It's changed how they develop. They express behaviors that allow them to be friendlier earlier, and they express them for the endurance of their life, whereas chimps have a much shorter window for many of those behaviors. And that change in development is sort of the key to how bonobos do what they do. And the sexual behavior is part of that, because crazy enough, we see that bonobos are having these sociosexual behaviors as early as 6 months. And even when we have peer-reared orphans where there's no adults, they still are having the species-appropriate sexual responses at stressful moments. When there's an acute stressor in the group, like you during feeding time, where there might be a fight if it was infant chimpanzees, which we actually compared them to, and there are fights, and they don't have the sociosexual behavior. Bonobos, when you go to feed them, they all get anxious and they rub their genitals with each other, and then they eat peacefully. And so that seems to fit this idea that you increase the oxytocin, you reduce stress, and they can get along. So they show that at 6 months, and then they show that behavior, and it is non-reproductive, as you suggested. Chimpanzees are much more puritanical in their sexual behavior. It seems that males are only attracted to females sexually when they're tumescent, meaning they're fully swollen, and they're most willing to fight for them within a period of 3-4 days when they're about to ovulate. Bonobo males are constantly attracted to females. Sex happens throughout the cycle. Whether females are ovulating or not, males don't really care. And females are having sexual interactions with each other through all that time.
Is it even known? Like, so in humans, is ovulation hidden?
Bonobo ovulation is less honest than chimpanzees. We know that chimpanzees have a very honest indicator of ovulation. Right. So they're swelling. We know that male chimpanzees know, like literally within hours of when females are going to ovulate. And so alpha chimpanzees will expend incredible amounts of energy to monopolize the female during that period. And that's actually when female chimpanzees are at most threat from aggression by males. Mm. So males will, instead of attacking another male, the male's like, oh, well, I'll just beat her up and then I'll scare her to death and she'll stay near me, because she knows if she doesn't stay near me that I'm going to beat her up. And therefore, the males are scared of me too. And so I can monopolize. So none of that in bonobos. A male bonobo trying to attack a female to have sex with her, we know is actually inversely related to his success at mating with her. So male aggression towards females for mating chances, bad idea. So it ends up that female bonobos, in contrast to female chimpanzees, their ovulation is hidden. It's not hidden to the extent that humans are, where it's completely concealed. The swelling does indicate within a week or so when ovulation will occur, but it doesn't tell you within an hour or so when it's going to occur. And also, their swellings can be swollen throughout the cycle at random periods. So they're definitely more like humans than chimpanzees are that way. And so that's why when people are sort of like, oh, well, aren't chimpanzees the best model of our common ancestor? Well, it depends on which trait we're talking about. Because it ends up that if you're talking about non-reproductive sex, if you're talking about concealed ovulation, bonobos are a much better representative.
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? What do you think would have happened if Jane Goodall had studied bonobos rather than chimpanzees? We watched, there's a fantastic National Geographic documentary called Jane that I think we watched on the Disney Channel. Not that we have to do, we're not the sort of parents that use the Disney Channel, by the way, but we just happened to have it for that particular documentary. And then we watched Claudine André. And her documentary is available on Amazon Prime. I think it's much older. Her documentary, someone needs to redo that. It was a bit weird. Have you seen it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, she's got several, so...
Oh, okay. So the one that we watched was like weirdly anthropomorphized, you know, where the bonobo character was told from sort of a first-person human voice. It was very strange, but it was still very good. Definitely worth watching.
Yeah, Benny Out of the Wild, yes. So full disclosure, Claudine is my personal hero, and I'm on the board of her organization, so I will peddle and tell you how great she is till I'm blue in the face.
That's my question. It's like everybody knows who Jane Goodall is, and I'm sure that much was supposedly demonstrably learned about humans from chimpanzees, but what if Claudine André had been as famous as Jane Goodall? would that have made a difference, that precedence? Like, yeah, us thinking differently, you know, about ourselves if we'd discovered bonobos first.
It's interesting. It's kind of more interesting even than that, potentially, the history of science here. It's not just about Jane, because it ends up Louis Leakey was the person who funded Baruti Galdikas, Diane Fossey, and Jane Goodall to go study, orangutans, gorillas, and chimpanzees. No one went to work with bonobos. And it's because Louis Leakey was a subject of the Queen, was a British aristocrat, a scientist. And so, of course, they went to East Africa, former colonies and members of the Commonwealth. And all of those students went to throughout the Commonwealth to study apes that were in the Commonwealth. And Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, of course, was a Belgian territory. Yeah. And there was not a tradition in Belgium of doing anything about science in Congo other than exploitation. Not that there's a perfect colonial history for the British either, but in terms of science and having primatology, you know, take off as a thing, that just didn't happen. And so it really was tied up to the meeting where Africa was divided between the different colonies and why we end up having the view of great apes that we have. And I don't think it's by chance that then, as the social system of chimpanzees is characterized, that people who have a background of coming out of Victorian thought would gravitate to this idea that there's a species that has hierarchy and despotism and this intergroup conflict, and it's survival of the fittest, you know, and chimpanzees are just the latest example, and look, they're closely related to us. So I think it just fit a public narrative so perfectly. And so then in the popular mind, chimpanzees, they're a great model of what we would have been like without language and before we were civilized. I think your question is a great one. What if bonobos had been studied more and first? I think the view of human nature, assuming that people responded to data and science, would have been altered. I think some significant things may have been different. I think it would have been harder to continue to pound the drumbeat of survival of the fittest, as I think it's misconstrued in the popular mindset that it's always about being bigger and stronger. I think bonobos are a great example where friendliness is the most powerful strategy in life. And just like dogs and many other examples, they're another example of a huge success story through friendliness. And it's been fun as somebody who studies bonobos and chimpanzees, because a lot of times when you are testing a hypothesis and trying to examine things empirically, people have priors based on data, but also where they come from and how they think about the world. And I can't help but because I studied chimpanzees for 20 years, and I think they're amazing. I actually came to studying bonobos as somebody who'd already spent over a decade studying chimpanzee cognition. So I have many friends who study chimpanzees. But it was so funny to then start studying bonobos and see the reaction of people to the fact that we were finding things that made bonobos different in interesting ways, and sort of a way that was attractive popularly. The fact that they're so friendly, it disturbed people. People felt uncomfortable about that. And so there was a lot of, for instance, when we discovered that bonobos were xenophilic, that they would share with strangers, there was a lot of skepticism about that. And there were good reasons for that. But I couldn't help but feel that some of it was that people were having a hard time dealing with the fact that, yes, there can be a species that survives and thrives through increases in friendliness.
How do you think this Hobbesian view of the world has stuck then, this sort of nasty, brutish, and short thing that seems to still be pervasive even to this day?
Well, I'm not suggesting that there isn't competition in nature. Absolutely not. I think what I'm saying is friendliness and cooperation allows you to win at the competition. I'm not saying it's Shangri-La and all the little animals are running around dancing in a flower-filled circle or whatever.
Would you please?
Yeah, I mean, I like to read fairy tales too, but that's not what I'm suggesting the science is saying. I'm saying that species that find a new way to be friendly and cooperate dominate. And species that sort of in their ecological niche must have despotism to thrive. That's a hard strategy. It's not always as successful if you end up having direct competition with a friendlier, more cooperative species.
Right. Well, this is all great, the work you've done on chimpanzees and bonobos, but you know, how does all this relate to humans?
One of the things we've typically see animals being used for is if you want to know what it is to be human, you have to first know what it is to be not human. And so I've done a lot of work in that direction where you're trying to understand, is a cognitive ability unique and special to humans? So for instance, using gestural communication, developmental psychologists argued that this is something that only humans do, is understand the intention behind a gesture. So I gesture and you're reading my mind, interpreting right. my gesture. Right. That's something that was thought to be only done in humans. Now we have evidence that our dogs are doing the same thing in a similar level of flexibility that we observe in 9 to 12 month old infants. So animals help say, okay, that idea that we thought was special to humans, we're not as special as we thought. So I do a lot of that. A lot of people thought that only humans and not bonobos and chimpanzees could think about the thoughts of others. So we now know that chimpanzees understand what others perceive. We know that they understand what others intend. They even understand what others believe in some cases and what they don't know. And so there's another way, though, that animals are super helpful and incredibly powerful in testing the ultimate challenge that Darwin lays before us in both The Origin of the Species and Descent of Man, which is once you figure out what is derived or unique in humans, how did it happen? What was the process? And the argument is, in The Origin and Descent, is that there was a purposeless mechanism, natural selection, that drove to the most purposeful psychology, say human morality and our ability to share experiences like the ones we are today through language. So a purposeless mechanism led to purpose. That's quite a high bar that as scientists we have to meet. So animals help us deal with that incredible challenge, because if we can understand how animals evolve from each other and how different species have been shaped by evolution to have different psychologies from one another, we can then get inference about ourselves. And so what we've seen in comparing wolves and dogs, chimpanzees and bonobos, is that selection for friendliness is an incredibly powerful force in shaping their psychology. And we had the stunning realization that, gosh, maybe this is something that happened in humans, that maybe that's part of the human story. And we really scratched our heads about this for a really long time. And Mike Tomasello, again, great collaborator and very helpful in sort of challenging our thinking here, because this is something Richard Rangeman and I started to think about when I was in graduate school with him. He was my PhD advisor. And Mike said to us, well, you know, that's great about selection for friendliness and human evolution, but if the process we're seeing that led to dogs or to bonobos is critical to becoming human, how come they're not linguistic? how come they're not driving cars and they don't have morality like we do? Good luck. And so we really scratched our heads on that for a really long time and couldn't really answer that challenge. But the last 10 years of paleoanthropological research have really shed light on where selection for friendliness may have had an important role in our species evolution. I think most of the focus has been on the evolution of our genus Homo. Where does Homo come from? And that's usually where a lot of the work with non-human apes has focused on trying to explain, because we have a last common ancestor. If we study early hominins, that comparing chimps and bonobos to those guys is going to be really powerful. But now what we know is that humans, our species was not alone on this planet. There were other human species till at least 50,000 years ago, maybe as much as 25,000 years ago. That is crazy. My joke is, you think it's hard to line up at the airport now? Like, imagine if there were multiple human species still alive today that we had to interact with. So we know that for most of human evolution, our species, Homo sapien, evolved arguably 200,000 to 300,000 years ago. So for most of our species evolution, there were other human species on the planet, as many as 4 to 5 species. They all had large brains. They all were cultural. They likely were linguistic, possibly even to the level that we are. I don't know. I can't tell you that, but certainly they were cultural. We know from the artifactual remains of Neanderthal society that they were very sophisticated. How did we win? Why are we the only ones here?
Right.
I mean, literally till, you know, 50,000 years ago, we were not alone. There were going to be multiple human species, but they're all gone. What happened to them? In fact, Neanderthals arguably had larger brains than we do. I mean, usually the story we tell ourselves, and if you asked anybody on the street, and you can do this, you say to somebody, where do humans come from? What was our secret to our success? And people will say things like, oh, well, we have big brains, or we have language, we have culture. Well, none of that works here, because all of those species had those things.
Right.
So it had to be something else that led to our species success. So I think that that was the moment we realized, wait a second, that's where self-domestication could provide a powerful explanation. And so that's what the book is all about, is exploring the idea of what we learned with animals and trying to apply it to late human evolution. And can it help us explain how we survived and succeeded and other human species did not? And I think the answer is yes. I think we're the friendliest species of human to ever evolve.
I think your book goes a long way to explain some of the worst human behavior as well, though, wouldn't you agree?
Well, that was one of the, you know, exciting things and challenges, is that the same abilities that allow us to be friendly, and that what friendliness enables, is the most sophisticated theory of mind abilities. So the most sophisticated ability to think about the thoughts of others, for me to imagine what it's like to be Chris interviewing me, to imagine what the audience is experiencing or not, and then feeling like I should do something more because I'd like to share with you, because, you know, we're doing this thing together and we have this joint goal of learning together about interesting things. I mean, that's the core of what friendliness enables in our argument. But those same cognitive abilities, and this is the shocking surprise in reviewing the literature and studying this, is those same cognitive abilities can turn off. They can go away. We don't just universally always apply those psychological resources to everyone and every group of people we interact with. And so we're actually quite discriminating in who we turn this uniqueness towards and deliver it to. And so what we argue in the book is that the darkest parts of our nature, the parts that we really need to be worried about, that lead to the worst things, genocide and mass murder, et cetera, it's a product actually of these unique features that evolve late in our human evolution becoming dampened and not applying them to different groups that we feel threaten our own group identity. So I do think that we have a potential explanation for selection for friendliness in humans to allow us to expand our social networks, actually sowing the seeds of the darkest parts of our nature.
Can you give us a specific example? I think you talked about Otter Benga in the book, which is a really nice example of that.
Yeah. So obviously in the United States right now at this moment, we're all worried and concerned about the treatment of minorities and structural racism. In the book, we just sort of try to take the lens even farther back though, and not just ask about the case of the United States, but also let's think about humans. And when you look at humans, there's so many anecdotal cases, like the case of Otto Benga, who was a pygmy hunter-gatherer in Central Africa. He lived in Democratic Republic of Congo, and he was captured and sort of forced to live in the Western world and was really miserable. And he was put on display in zoos and sort of totally used to propagate the notion implicitly and explicitly that civilized Western society was somehow superior. And effectively, his whole life was an exercise in dehumanizing a group of people that didn't rely on agriculture and hadn't been industrialized, but lived a perfectly happy modern life as hunter-gatherers. So when you look back at not just the case of Otto Benga, but you look at the case of so many historical events that are sort of the worst parts of history, we even have a map in the book where we basically ask, okay, let's look over 200 years, the last 200 years. Is there any place on the planet, is there a continent on the planet where there hasn't been mass murder, genocide, democide, where governments actually organize mass murders? Is there any place where these things haven't happened? And the only continent we could find evidence for that was Antarctica. If they're humans, there's genocide. If there's humans, there's democide. So that does seem like a problem. And we're, you know, for survival of the friendliest, if I'm arguing that we're the friendliest species that ever evolved. But this is where mechanism really matters a lot. And what we're proposing is that the mechanism that allows us to be friendly and have theory of mind, it's coupled with one other really unique feature of humans. And this is something that I truly think is unique. being someone, I already, you know, the story of dogs and arguing with my advisor that dog gestural communication refutes the idea that we're unique in the way we use gestures. And so prove me wrong. I would love that. I'm happy to, I think the hypothesis is falsifiable, but we are unique as a species. I don't think there's any other species that has the notion of group identity. I do not think that group identity exists in any non-humans. And I think that late in human evolution, we evolved the concept of group identity. And that occurred because of selection for friendliness that made us attracted to strangers. But not just strangers like bonobos, and not using the mechanism where bonobos are xenophilic. Bonobos, if they see an unfamiliar bonobo, they're attracted to them. That is not the human state. We are not attracted to those that are unfamiliar to us. We're attracted to those that are unfamiliar and match our group identity. Whatever that group identity is, it's incredibly plastic and flexible in how we think of other groups. So we evolve this ability to recognize strangers as actually group members, people we've never met before. You and I haven't met before today. We share a common interest, a curiosity, and an approach to thinking about reality, instantly friends. That is us recognizing each other's group identity and instantly forming a rapport. No other species does that. If we were two bonobos, they could be friendly, but it would be because they had been unfamiliar with each other. They were curious about one another, and maybe they could be friends. It's not because of group identity. So this group identity allows us to cooperate and collaborate with much larger groups of individuals. It forms a much larger social network. It means that innovators are now sharing ideas across what would have been small groups, no more than 100, 150 individuals. Now we're trading ideas, we're trading goods, because we can recognize that groups neighboring us share our identity in some way. And you have cultural ratcheting, this idea that when innovations occur, we can actually not just use the cultural artifact, but we can even improve upon it and share that improvement to the future generation without slippage. So that cultural ratchet effect just launches into a new trajectory, into hyperdrive, because you have more innovators that can innovate and more ratcheting going on. That puts us at a totally different technological place relative to other human species at the same period that are still recognizing and being fearful of other groups based on familiarity. As soon as you have group identity, you can now apply your theory, your unique theory of mind abilities to those new group members, cooperate, collaborate with them, and you care about them as if they were family, as if they were your kin. And so then this sets up the dark side, which is now there are these strangers that you've met. You recognize them as your group members, even though you've never seen them before. You feel as if they're family. You welcome them in. You interact and, you know, learn and share things with them. But what happens when they are threatened? What happens, even more importantly, when your group identity is threatened? Well, it's just as if your family member, your offspring had been threatened. You have the same emotional response. Because we love more people more, we are more susceptible to feeling that those individuals are threatened. And therefore, that same mechanism that allows for all this friendliness has evolved to be able to shut down and dampen and allows us to then morally exclude and potentially be quite violent against those that might threaten those we love.
Right. You're making me think of the mama bear analogy that I think I've heard you make before, perhaps not in the book, but definitely in the presentation before.
Right? No. We do it in the book.
Oh, it's in the book too?
Yeah. Okay. It's more concise than what I just said, which is why we came up with it. So the mama bear, the idea is, the way to think about this mechanism metaphorically is, when is a bear, a beautiful polar bear, most nurturing and loving and friendly? It's when they have their new offspring. They're playing in the snow. They're sliding down the hill together. She's nursing. They're playing and pawing each other, whatever. And when is the exact moment that a bear is most deadly and most likely to be aggressive and violent? It's a mama bear. When she would do anything to protect her offspring, she is willing to sacrifice herself. She'd be willing to take on a much bigger bear. Things that would seem irrational from an economic standpoint. Why would you take on a bear that, you know, weighs 20% more than you? Well, because you're protecting your offspring. I think what's happened is that same mechanism has been co-opted in human evolution to apply not just to our kin and offspring, but to our groups
that
we share group identity with.
I'm not sure this refutes your hypothesis, but it must be new, right? So if you think about hunter-gatherers, the most different person that you ever saw during your lifetime would be someone from, I don't know, 12 miles away. And they would probably look just like you, right? Like, it's only once you get, I don't know, what do you think, like 60,000, 15,000 years for some parts of the world, once you see people migrating out of wherever you think the cradle of humanity is, that you would ever see another person that looked different from you. So surely this group selection hypothesis, it must be recent.
Well, I mean, I guess it just depends, because having spent a lot of time in different places in the world, there are groups of people who recognize differences within their own group that if you're from outside that group, you don't see. And so I think you're right. I don't think that an Eskimo would have met a Turi pygmy until very recently. I don't think, you know, during our evolutionary period, you know, evolutionary history, 50,000 years onward, those two groups were meeting. But I also think that when neighboring groups of, let's say, Neanderthals would meet, I don't think the question was, oh my gosh, you're so different because you look different. You're not familiar to me. I don't know you. Mm-hmm. And so you're a threat. And it's the same with chimpanzees. And so I think what happened was that when group identity evolves, it's this wonderful innovation where now we're on the border, we meet each other. I don't know you, but you wear the same clothing. You use the same style of tool that I make. So you're in our kin group. Now, south of me, there's a group that hasn't adopted those technologies or those techniques, and we're having a hard time getting along with them. And we have a much more violent rivalry between us. And so I think that's would be sort of the scenario that I imagine this works under.
So what do we need to do? How do you look out for this? So if you appreciate that this groupishness is an important part of what has made us human, but then also it could be our Achilles heel. So what do you need to watch out for?
Yeah, our strength is our weakness. The problem is too much love. So, and in that way, you know, you mentioned Paul Bloom before. And in that way, I think this is where Paul Bloom and I would agree is, often people are saying we need more empathy. We need more empathy. It's true if you assume that when we have more empathy, we just universally humanize everyone that is human. But if you understand that our brain is not built to humanize everyone, it is meant to humanize those we recognize as sharing a group identity with us, and that we dehumanize those that threaten those with our group identity, empathy towards our group identity increasing actually can lead to increased dehumanization of those we feel threaten us. So I do agree that empathy is a good thing. If you then understand, and if we're correct that this mechanism exists and that it's the same mechanism sort of toggling on and off directed at different groups and people. So what do we do is the question. And so in the book, we spend the latter half of the book saying, okay, if we really are the friendliest species that ever evolved, we have this darker side. Okay, well, what does that mean for our world if we're really characterizing human nature accurately? So I don't think technology will be the solution to this problem. I don't think that technology alone can solve the problem, because I think better internet connectivity via social media, as we have seen over the last 10 years, it has wonderful benefits, but our darker side shows up. Maybe there's a delay, but it'll come. The question I often get when I give a popular talk on this topic is people say, well, gosh, if friendliness was key, and if you're saying selection for friendliness leads to the secret success of our species, why don't we just breed people to be more friendly? I don't think that that will work either. I don't think that selecting for friendliness will help us. In
like Baev's foxes, right? Like, we're all going to have floppy ears and a Bentley and curly tails.
Yeah. So that's exactly telling the story of the foxes, where there was selection for friendliness, and that led to friendlier foxes that had curly tails and floppy ears. And I went and studied them and found they're even better at understanding humans and human communication.
That's amazing.
As a byproduct, they didn't select for cognitive ability, but they are more cognitively sophisticated when it comes to cooperating and communicating with humans. That was a place where I was wrong. Richard Wrangham said that was going to be what we found. And I was like, no way. So that was really a fun, you know, science moment where the data is coming in. And I'm like, there's no way they're going to. You have to have selection on cognition. It's cognition. It can't be a byproduct. Oops. Okay. But it ended up reality was much more interesting. So we found the foxes have this cooperative communicative ability like dogs. So that then often leads people to say, well, gosh, if you can select for friendliness and end up being more socially savvy, and you think it's so important for human evolution, why don't we just select people to be more friendly? Well, if you reflect on the Fox experiment, the first thing you learn is, even though eugenics is morally repugnant, we shouldn't even be thinking about it. There are historians that can do a better job explaining why it's horrendously awful. So as a biologist, let me leave that to the historians, and I'll tell you from a biological perspective, not only is it morally repugnant, it wouldn't work. And here's why it wouldn't work is, number one, when the foxes were selected, they allowed 1% of the population to breed each year. So with 7 billion plus humans on the planet, explain to me how you're only going to have 1% of people reproduce. That's number one. That's the first problem. The selection is extreme. Second is, in choosing the foxes, they had a test that actually identified the type of friendly behavior that they wanted to encourage in future generations. We don't know how to characterize and measure individual differences in friendly behavior in humans, and we certainly know that, unlike other animals, most of our social behavior is buffered because we have polygenic behavioral traits where literally hundreds of genes are involved in determining height, determining maybe 40% of the individual variability in height. When it comes to behavior, it's thousands, maybe tens of thousands of genes. So there's no way we could identify the test, all the thousands of genes, and then require 1% of the world to reproduce.
Right. And of course, more importantly, it's the triumph of the environment, right? Chapter 8 in Sapolsky is like, it's really, okay, so tell me about your early life experiences and I'll tell you about the adult behavior. Like,
right.
You can't control for that either.
That's right. That's right. And then there's random noise that no one can explain that determines a lot of differences in behavior. So I think for friendliness, what we turn to is say, look, actually, we already know what the solutions are. We already do them really, really well. We just need to go back and work on them again, knowing what human nature is and appreciating what the potential power of solutions that have already been invented and we know work. And basically the idea is, a social problems require social solutions. And democracy is really the most powerful method that has ever been invented to have large populations of humans make decisions and basically interact in an extraordinarily friendly way if you take the big picture of what is possible through democratic discourse. And the other thing we land on, in terms of, you were mentioning environmental experience for individuals, and okay, that's great at a societal level, and we can talk more about democracy. But at the societal level, what kind of policy recommendations and sort of what are the innovations that we can push forward to increase friendliness? And I think we know. I think there's a ton of data that suggests what we need to encourage. And in a hypothesis, I would call it the contact hypothesis. But if you're a dog lover, it's socialization. Let's put it this way. If you're getting a new puppy, what's the most important thing I can tell you besides the fact that you're not going to sleep for a few weeks? It is get your puppy out and make sure they experience as much about the world as possible, as early as possible, so that they have confidence. And that later, when they meet someone who is, you know, maybe smells a certain way, or maybe is a certain height, or maybe has a certain voice, they've already experienced that in a positive way, and they're not afraid of that.
Right.
And so we see the same thing in our own experience, in our own species. If we early in life have had positive contact with diverse groups of people, we're less likely to be threatened, and we are less likely to have our own group identity threatened by those that may appear to be unlike us. So the more contact, the better. And there are very specific recommendations that we can walk through, everything from why cooperative learning should be encouraged, why I think it's good that a lot of universities are randomizing freshman dorm assignments pre and hopefully post COVID, and why peaceful protests, for instance, are far more powerful in moving the dial than violent protests. There's beautiful data to show why. And I think self-domestication and understanding human nature through self-domestication tells us why it's so effective and should be encouraged. And I think the final one is even how we think about our representative government. If democracy is fantastic at Ideally, it is giving voices to the voiceless. It allows a minority power to maintain power. It's not a zero-sum game by design. It may be effectively in many cases, but conceptually, it shouldn't be. And if we want all those things to work, then we have to defend against the dehumanization of our rivals, because in a liberal democracy, you can't afford to have enemies. You can't dehumanize your enemies. You need to humanize your rivals. You can disagree about arguments and policy, but the number one thing that you cannot do to have an effective democracy is to dehumanize fellow members of your country or really anyone. And so one of the ways that we can protect against that, and it would cost no money almost, and it would be incredibly effective. The no money solution is you'd have representative leaders sitting alphabetically in the chambers during debate, whether it's in parliament or Congress, not by party. Number two is that you would, in the United States, most people don't know that when you say Congress, and by the way, Congress's approval rating is usually hovering around 15 to 20%. So as bad as, say, the current president's approval rating is right now, it's still double what our Article I representative government's approval rating is. And when people are thinking about the Senate and the House of Representatives, they're always thinking of the individual representative, but that person has an office, and that office that runs their work is typically 20-year-olds who are volunteering or paid next to nothing. And the solution, if you want to humanize and make sure that in our republic, we're not dehumanizing one another and we have policies to protect everyone, we need Republican staffers and Democratic staffers to go to lunch. We need them to go to lunch at least once a month. And I think the federal government should pay for it. I think that we should fund bipartisan lunches and they just go to lunch. That's it. They get a free lunch if they go with somebody from a staff member from another party. And it's just to encourage friendship, because when we have cross-group friendship, you do not have dehumanization.
Did you have any thoughts on this factor of scale? So the Swiss system of cantons does seem to work quite well, doesn't it? And is it that in the US, just the geographic regions are just too damn big? And the reason it's a problem is because the intolerant minority prevails. So if you think about Canada, for example, there are some regions of Canada where people speak both French and English, but because English people don't speak French, right? The intolerant minority prevails. And so everybody ends up speaking English, right?
Right.
And so is it that just in the US, California is just so massive, you know, Texas is just so huge. Do you need to break these states up into smaller cantons?
I don't know. In the book, we highlight a whole bunch of things that people have talked about that are problems that the US faces. You know, we have the oldest constitution. EU constitutions have much richer bills of rights. Our representatives have been negligent or problematic in their invention of things like the Hastert rule that are designed to prevent bipartisan compromise. There was a war against pork barrel spending, which honestly I bought into till I wrote this book. I thought, what wasteful spending to spend money on these sort of special projects that help very few people. But thinking about survival of the friendliest, thinking about self-domestication and the fact that we have unique group identity and how we feel threatened and how we need bipartisan interdependency. We need the parties and members of the parties to be friends, to humanize one another as they're having their rivalrous interactions. But we also need them to have interdependence and a reason to want to work together. And right. So if you have the Hastert rule that basically makes it impossible to ever have bipartisanship, and if you take away pork barrel spending basically gives you the means to go across the aisle, and you can't get people in your party to agree, but you could maybe get somebody that you know has a special need in another party to sign on. And there's very nice demonstrations by political scientists that you can get amazing amounts of collaboration and bills fare much better if there is the ability to have pork barrel spending. So at its worst, it was less than 1% of federal spending. So I think to have collaboration, compromise, bipartisanship, moderation, I think 1% of the federal budget is worth it. I don't think it's wasteful spending if you think about what it actually does at greasing the gears of compromise. So on the Canton you know, is the United States too big? I mean, that was an original question of the founders had to worry about. And that's an argument that has gone back and forth and political scientists have argued about ad nauseum. I'm reading a book by David Stasevich, and he's arguing that, and the title of the book says it all, it's The Decline and Rise of Democracy. His argument is that there were many early democracies and that what predicted the success of early democracies, say in Anglo-Saxon England, was the lack of a bureaucracy and the need for councils to help collect taxation. And that it was the presence of bureaucracy in China and the Middle East that prevented democracy, large-scale democracies from occurring. So I think that diagnosis is very post hoc. I think we have 244 years of success under our belt. I think the union can be strong again, e pluribus unum. I think it's really a whole host of issues, whether it's being able to have K Street and lobbyists really influence too heavily what representatives do and think, how they get elected, and mechanisms within the Hastert rule, pork barrel spending, et cetera. I think we can walk through things like this. We don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think the reason that the self-domestication hypothesis helps is I think that all of the things we're describing, all those fixes, those are just effects of the psychological problem. Underriding psychological problem is dehumanization. That the discourse has moved from competition, friendly competition like you'd have on the sports pitch, where, oh, while we're playing the game, we are not happy with each other and I'm going to do anything to beat you. But afterwards, we shake hands, we go out and have a beer. Okay, it's moved from that to, no, you really are not even human. You're not even human. And I don't even think of you as a moral being. So I don't think it's a question of the size of the country. I think it's a question of
the dehumanization,
the underlying psychology and that darker part of our nature bubbling up to the surface and starting to dominate and even affecting what mechanisms we're designing to have run our government. And it's not going to work. We have to humanize each other if our democracy and if any democracy is going to flourish.
Well, I think that's a nice place to wrap up. I applaud you in the ambitiousness of your project here. You start with this super low level stuff like the neural crest cells and the self-domestication syndrome and what you learn from your dog. And then you end up in moral psychology and political science and all this super high level stuff. Yeah, that's ambitious indeed. And I would encourage everybody to go out and get a copy of the new book. It's going to be very, very new as you hear this podcast, Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. What else have you got going on online? Where can people find you, follow your work?
I think I'm most active on Twitter. At BeHairDogGuy is my Twitter handle. That's probably where I am most active and share things most readily.
Okay. And where can people learn about how best to choose a puppy and train a dog and all that kind of stuff? Like, where's your favorite? I can't resist. That's the bonus question, the addendum. Like, it's a really hard problem, isn't it? When I went to go and get a dog, I really didn't know like any of these things. Like, and then there's so much information out there that is just not backed. You know, I went with this guy that was teaching this top dog method of training a dog and it seemed to work well for me. But of course, I've got no counterfactual. And it's like really hard to find like evidence-based approaches to all this kind of stuff. Have you got any books or resources you like for people thinking about getting a dog?
That's the next book.
You're kidding me. You've got to be kidding. So for the listeners, the backstory it was here is I read this book, The Genius of Dogs, and there's this small part in it about the self-domestication syndrome and survival of the friendliest. And when I reached out to Brian, I said, oh, I really like that book, The Genius of Dogs, but I don't really want to talk about dogs. I want to talk about the survival of the friendliest thing. He said, well, you're not going to get, this is my new book. Like, you've got to be kidding. And so I've done it again.
Thank you. Yes, you did. Yeah, the next book, we're just starting writing it, but that is the next book. And until that book's out, I would go to the Humane Society and read their advice because they're people who they're not selling you anything. They're trying to help you find a good dog and they don't want dogs ending up in shelters. So what you have to understand is that people who breed dogs are trying to sell something. Doesn't mean that they're not selling a wonderful product, but you just need to keep that in the back of your mind. And anything they say, there should be some evidence. So I'll give you one example. Everybody's heard of hypoallergenic dogs. Okay, so there are several studies now that show that the protein that's in dog saliva that causes the allergic reaction and gets on their dander and floats in the air, there is absolutely no difference in the level of that dander in the air of breeds that are claimed to be hypoallergenic and those that are not. It is all branding and marketing. It is that breeders who were trying to sell dogs were having a hard time selling dogs because people were saying, I'm allergic, I can't have them. So people say, oh, you won't be allergic to this dog. this dog is hypoallergenic.
Yeah.
And they probably believed it. They probably believed that their dog was hyperallergenic because how could anybody prove them wrong? Well, they could do the study where they measure the dander and it's been done and it's totally nothing. There's nothing there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've heard about those Labradoodle puppies selling for $5,000 each for that exact reason. That's nuts.
I would just say it's hard because the other thing is, another example I can give you, if you go to the AKC website, and I'm a big fan of, I think AKC does many wonderful things, but if you go to their website, they describe all the different breeds that they recognize, breeds of dogs. And the farther you go down the page, the sort of ooey gooier the descriptions get. As they start, they're talking about how tall the dog is. They're talking about the shape of the ears. I mean, they are very specific. How many hands and you know what shape and how you should measure from this earlobe to that earlobe. You get down to the bottom about the dog's personality, intelligence, and they're just words. Trainable, obedient, loyal. And if you go across all the different breeds, they're all very positive for every breed. People are not breeding dogs based on behavioral characteristics in any systematic way. The dogs that are being bred, that are purebred, are being bred based on appearance, primarily.
Right.
And so that's the challenge. The challenge is that it is not the case that breeders are breeding based on appearance and behavioral traits. The simple question you can ask a breeder is, so what are the measures you use to measure behavioral traits as you chose individuals to breed? Where are the measurements? And they'll tell you a story. Oh, she's really sweet and loyal and da-da-da. That's not measuring anything.
Right.
That's an impression and intuition, and it may be spot on correct, or it could be totally wrong.
Right. You've actually just like perfectly summarized my problem. I went to the kennel first to get a dog, and my wife had told, of course, that's why you get a specific breed of dog, is because your wife told you to get a specific breed of dog. So we found like one of these dogs in the kennel, and it looked great. You know, we walk up to it, and then just as we got close, it sort of looked at us sideways and just started snarling. And I've got an 18-month-old daughter at this point, and I'm thinking, and we're gone.
Yeah,
and
then, that's so bad we ended chemistry.
So we ended up going to this breeder, and she was showing dogs, I believe, you're right, that's really what they're optimizing for, is the appearance of the dog. However, she also had young children and she was living on a farm, and I could watch her kids torturing these puppies and they were behaving. I was like, perfect. So that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And so she was breeding pets as well as the appearance.
Yeah.
For the...
And so I don't think there's better advice than that. I think the first thing is, do not get a dog you have not met and personally interacted with. Do not get a family member who's going to be in your family for 10 to 12 years that you're going to literally pay, on average, an American will pay $20,000 in the lifespan of the dog. It's $15,000 to $20,000 investment, and you're not even going to go see your new family member. Go to the family member, do an interview, basically. And best case is, like you did, you can see them interacting with kids, or you see their parents. You see the parents of the dogs, and you can see that it's not perfect. It's going to explain only maybe 50% of the variability, but it's a lot better than saying, oh, there's this essence of a Doberman, a pincher. They're guard dogs and they're aggressive. And the essence of a Cocker Spaniel is that they're sweet lap dogs that are supportive and loving. It's like, oh man, that's not going to end well.
Well, I'll look forward to, you've just teased us now. I'll look forward to the next book then. Maybe we can touch
we'll do it again.
And you do it again. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. Thank you, Brian.
No worries. Thank you, Chris.